that being treated differently is not sexy, right?
No.
Implications that you do not belong aren't sexy. Being asked where you came from, because, you know, hearing that over and over again implies that you don't belong here.
I have a problem with this, because if you were to Google, like, beautiful, what comes up under Google images, search for beautiful, go and have a look at that and then tell me, like, why I should have a problem.
There aren't too many people that fit the really narrow standards that are being pushed at us in the Western world.
Yeah. And it should come as no surprise that this would then affect how someone feels about, you know, spending a little time with someone in the bedroom. Come on. That's all about sex. About 20 past 11, my name's Maya Billick and I'm joined by Tanya Koontz. Sorry, Tanya Koontz. I have no idea what sound my mouth just made. But it is time for Let's Talk About Sex. Tanya, how are you? What's cracking?
I'm very well, thanks. It's always a pleasure to be here. Thanks
for having
me. It's
always fun to have you on.
Yeah, and then we get to do a little bit of deep diving today in a topic that's dear to my heart.
Yeah, I'm excited. Yeah. In case you missed it, about a fortnight ago, we started unpacking the effects of oppression and what effects they can have on a day-to-day in the lives of marginalized people. Just before we get into some of the nitty-gritty, Tanya, let's do a quick recap. What concepts did we go over last fortnight?
Okay, so what we went over last fortnight is that oppression is something that isn't taught to us, but it's learned. Right? We watch how others are treated and we mimic it. Right. So, and what oppression actually boils down to is it's making some people not okay because of their bodies. Like when you distill it all down, it's whether they've got differently abled bodies, what size body they have, what race they are, what skin color, sometimes what gender, what sexual orientation. All of a sudden then, some folks have a body that they're trying to change to fit in with dominant discourses in society, or society's rejecting them in some way because of their bodies, right? So that's a bit unfair. Mm. And that the impact of this is you're kind of treating your body as an apology or as a project that needs to be worked on, right? So that's sort of the politics behind pleasure, because we're going to get down to that. Some of the ways that that can show up for people is in the form of microaggressions, right? These are little tiny things that happen to people every day from people who may or may not be aware that they're oppressing them. So we use a term sometimes like casual racism, right? So being questioned, should you be here? I think I mentioned that I have a client who's a person of color and she's often the keynote speaker at a conference. And every single time she goes to a conference or a workshop, security come up and ask to see her lanyard and whether she should be there, right?
Oh,
yes, I know. People getting tailed by security guards or having your ability questioned in public or in your workplace. People with thick accents, often their intelligence levels are assumed because they've got a thick accent, which I find quite remarkable. Being asked to repeat yourself all the time, being compared to folks of a different race to your own, being told that your name's difficult to pronounce. Why don't you just ask how to pronounce it rather than making a pronouncement like that? Constantly being questioned about your sexuality, being asked where you came from, because, you know, hearing that over and over again implies that you don't belong here. And things like casual racism, not being served in a queue, not being picked up by taxis. I made mention of, and I think we're going to put the links up, of a very powerful 3-minute dialogue by actor Maine Wyatt on Q&A on the ABC. I think everybody should have a little look at that, because it was what it's like for him to live in his body and how he's treated. Very, very powerful. And then we talked a little bit about spoon theory, which is kind of the theory that people assume that we're all born with this, we're all given the same amount of energy every day, and we are. But sometimes different things take up more energy. So like constantly being asked where you come from is tiring. Mm. Being asked to repeat yourself is tiring. Assuming that somebody with a different ability can get dressed and meet you for lunch with the same amount of energy that you might expend as an able-bodied person is tiring. So understanding that oppression saps people of their energy, just doing little tiny things that in inverted commas, normal people of society do, people with more privilege don't have to expend, right? Mm. So we can understand why people are tired. And that's important for for us to get, because I think a lot of us simply don't understand, why is it so hard? Why are you so tired? Why are you so angry? Why are you so cranky about these things?
Yeah. I mean, if you do have some time, go and check out the Let's Talk About Sex podcast and listen back to the whole show in full. It really kind of gives you a good picture of the context. And it might make a bit more sense than to now why we're going into how, beyond an everyday life, how does this affect the bedroom? How does this affect marginalized people's relationships, their sex lives? Because it does.
Yeah, right. And it's not something that you would think about overtly, is it?
No.
No. You know, I did a bit of research around this because last year I was asked to chat to my industry body conference. And, you know, whenever I'm given a platform to say something, I like to try and get people thinking and ruffle a few feathers. So I gave this talk, which really stood people on their ear, because they didn't really understand, and this is us, the helping professionals, that being treated differently is not sexy, right?
No.
Implications that you do not belong aren't sexy, and it can affect, it's not only your safety stuff, because, you know, a lot of the time people are very anxious and afraid and traumatized and triggered, and none of those things are particularly sexy, but your self-esteem gets impacted if you feel like you're in somehow not okay, your body's made to be, and again I'm holding up air quotes, not natural. Like, I don't understand how a body can be not natural. All bodies are natural. And people are tired from dealing with daily microaggressions. You know, it looks like burnout, but it isn't. What it is being asked to survive or function in a system that's really unfair, right? So that's not going to make you feel good about yourself and not very sexy. And, you know, I think when people are lacking in self-confidence, or they're tired, or their head's constantly spinning over what's not going okay for them, they don't really feel that sexy. They don't feel adventurous, you know. So sometimes people can get stuck in routine sex. Sometimes people can hold themselves back and think, well, look, nothing sexy about me today. I got told 75 different ways and somehow I'm not okay.
Yeah.
So it shuts people down effectively, and it inhibits their ability to experience pleasure. And we'll come back to that a little bit later as we're chatting, but that's a very important thing, because we all need to be able to and open to experience pleasure.
Yeah, I mean, I've been taking the last few weeks to rewatch Donald Glover's series Atlanta, and it was one of the most recent episodes with basically the scene is set that they're going to a party at Drake's house, and there are all these beautiful young black women just like in this house going crazy, trying to find Drake. And one of the characters, I think, puts it best. She's trying to not pick a fight with this white woman, but she notices this one guy that she really likes and thinks, oh, like, finally I might have a chance, like there's something I could build into something here, but notices that he's taken and that he's in an interracial relationship. And she kind of sassily starts, like, not picking a fight, but talking to the white woman, and she makes a point, like, I have a problem with this, because if you were to Google, like, beautiful, what comes up under Google images, search for beautiful, go and have a look at that and then tell me, like, why I should have a problem, because it's in everything. It's like, yeah, spouted in, like, the beauty industry, all throughout capitalism, really, like, the whole politics of pleasure is in every day, really.
Absolutely. If you Google yoga, you'll get skinny white women on a yoga mat. But yoga actually originated in India and in Africa, where people of color, you know. So I think, the things that are changing and our concepts of beauty, I think, are so narrow that people are almost having to perform to try and be beautiful. There aren't too many people that fit the really narrow standards that are being pushed at us in the Western world.
Yeah. And it should come as no surprise that this would then affect how someone feels about, like, you know, spending a little time with someone in the bedroom.
Yeah, I sit across from people all the time that think that they're unattractive, too fat, too this, too that, and really shutting themselves down. And what I see with my eyes wide open is a completely normal, beautiful human being that's totally capable of being sexy. But the system, again, and the world that we live in is shutting them down.
Yeah.
And that's, it upsets me greatly. And it's hard work to sort of unclench people's fingers from these tightly held beliefs about what beauty is and what okayness is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Tanya, do you think that these effects would be even more heightened in this moment where we're talking about the Black Lives Matter movement?
100%. Yeah. I think people of color around the world are feeling intense grief and anger and wanting to change the world operates. And it's not just them. There's a lot of folk of all shapes and sizes and races wanting to change things. It's not fair, and people have had enough. And we need to listen to this, right? Because none of the stuff that's going on is sexy at all. Life and death isn't sexy, and I know sometimes near-death experiences can make people want to seek out sex to feel alive, but that's a whole nother episode for us to chat about. I think what's happening now is that it's trauma is coming up, and it's very triggering for people who have already been impacted by impression and oppression and trauma. It heightens people's fear and feelings of vulnerability, and that can shut down your ability to sexually arouse, right? So in our body, we have the autonomic nervous system, and that's associated with fight, flight, freeze, and fawn. And we don't have control over that. Our body makes decisions for us according to whether it thinks we're in danger. When we get sent into fight and flight, so sometimes just breathing shallowly, if we're anxious about something or we're worried about somebody not making us okay, or if we're fearing for our lives, we'll take shallow breaths like that. And then our body goes, oh no, there must be a saber-tooth tiger somewhere around the corner. I think we should go into fight, flight, freeze, or fawn mode. And what happens is you get a rush of adrenaline so that you can punch something or run away. But also, your brain goes offline because you don't need your brain, your logic, rationale to have a chat with a saber-tooth tiger. You need to punch it or run away. Digestion goes offline, and also your ability to sexually arouse. So, people who are constantly traumatized or worried or fearing or anxious, they're not feeling very sexy because we're not supposed to be feeling sexy at times like that. We're supposed to be doing the things we need to do to survive. And I think a lot of folk just don't draw the line between those sorts of things. And, again, it's sort of not understanding that people fear for their lives. It really worries me that I see folk in America bringing up beautiful young men, people of color, and they're afraid that their kids will go out and not come home because of the systems over there. It is life and death for folks, and that's not very sexy or pleasurable.
No. And in this global conversation, bringing it to a local context, in Australia, the Black Lives Matter movement is very much about centering the experiences of First Nations people and this perception of decolonization, what it means, what it is, tangible ways of trying to achieve it, what's problematic with decolonization. Can we unpack a little bit of this giant convo?
Well, with decolonization, that, yeah, so that's a big one. That is around, consciously helping traumatized and oppressed people heal and repair and take up space. So it's leaving space for them to have specific landmarks, specific practices, spiritual practices. It's acknowledging, I think, what has happened, to folk as a people, and what's happening to them today, and sort of really understanding the impacts of what happens when the settlers came here. Because people are like, well, I'm white, but I didn't do anything. I'm not racist, is the common one. And why should I have to apologize for things that have happened in the past? And I'm okay. And people today are okay. But actually they're not. White people are really benefiting from assist from colonization and from terrible things that happen to indigenous populations. And those people then carry intergenerational trauma, right? I see a lot of people saying, oh, well, Aboriginal communities have problems because there's lots of violence and there's lots of this and there's lots of that. I'm like, yes. Have you wondered why they have that and why it's so much higher in these populations? It's because they're living with intergenerational trauma. They've had their children taken away. I learned the other day that all children taken away from their parents, Aboriginal children in the 60s, were given a criminal record. I'm just you can't see my face, but it's totally flabbergasted.
Yeah.
Flabbergasted. Like, I don't understand that. And what does that do to people? You know, and when you think, you know, so you can't make comments like that without understanding that you have not had to travel the pathways that many folk have, and that it's not in your bloodline and coming down. And one of the things we learn when we study counseling is that trauma is intergenerational. If you draw a genogram, you can see sexual abuse coming down through relation through generations. You can see drug and alcoholism. You can see mental health issues. Things travel down family lines. And I think we really need to understand this and understand that for people who live in places that have been colonized, we have been benefiting by taking away from other people.
We're going to leave it there just for a moment on Let's Talk About Sex. When we come back after this next track, we're going to start to try and unpack white fragility. So don't go anywhere on Mornings. There's a language warning on this track by SL and Kenny Beats. It's called Bad Luck.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah, look.
SL and Kenny Beats on Bad Luck. Joining me right now here on Mornings for Let's Talk About Sex is Tanya Coons, our resident pleasure expert, all-round excellent advice giver. We've been unpacking the politics of pleasure, which this whole topic that we've been taking apart today and a fortnight ago on Let's Talk About Sex stemmed from a conversation that, well, a talk rather, that Tanya gave a few weeks ago, and she wanted to revisit it, and we've been unpacking what it looks like in a daily context. But now we're going to flip it and look at white fragility and what white fragility is.
Yeah. Okay. So, and that's all, this is also, we could do like 17 episodes just on this.
Oh, yeah.
And I just want to posit that I am no expert in this. I, like many people, were reading up about it and trying to understand that. But it's an understanding that racism is systemic and it's not personal, right? And what systemic means is that it's encompassed in all aspects of life. We're going to experience this at school, at work, in social situations, in corporations, and from the government, right? It's really, really important to understand that racism is systemic. It's not personal, right? So saying, well, it can be, but it's not, but saying I'm not a racist does not absolve you from being complicit in a system that's not fair to many people. Refusing to talk about racism does not absolve you and make you not racist, and it does make you complicit in a system that's not fair to many people. I'd strongly recommend you can Google this, and we'll put a link up to it, to read Peggy McIntosh's paper, Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack. So she wrote this in the 1960s about white privilege and male privilege, and you know that it's expanded since then. But I think she wrote 168 questions that you can ask yourself to see what privilege you have, and to see if you are complicit in this systemic racism. So questions like, or statements like, I can, if I wish, arrange to be in the company of people of my race most of the time, right? I can avoid spending time with people who I was trained to mistrust or who I've learned to mistrust. If I should need to move, I can be pretty sure of renting or purchasing a house in an area which I can afford and in which I would like to live. Right? These are pretty, they're normal questions, you know, stuff that some folk never have to think twice about.
Mm.
I can be pretty sure that my neighbours in such a location will be neutral or pleasant to me. I could go shopping alone most of the time and pretty well be assured that I won't be followed or harassed. I can turn on the TV or see the front page of the newspaper and see people of my race widely represented, right? When I'm told about our national heritage or our civilization, I'm shown people of my color help making it what it is. These are everyday questions. I can be sure that my children will be given curriculum materials that testify to the existence of their race. There's a lot of chat about the education system now and what we're actually teaching.
Mm.
I don't have to educate my children to be aware of systemic racism for their own daily physical protection. Right? This, things like this, you know, they jolted me into awareness of what's going on for other people, because these are things that a lot of these things are things that I've never had to think about as a white person. And I think, I like this one. I can talk with my mouth full and not have this people put this down to my color. I'm like, really? Really? Yeah. I can swear or dress in secondhand clothes, not answer letters without having people attribute these choices to bad morals, poverty, or the illiteracy of my race. Right. So as you see these assumptions, and these are assumptions that people carry every day. I don't know how they learn them. We kind of osmose them by watching other people.
Mm.
I can do well in a challenging situation without being called a credit to my race, right? And I'm never asked to speak for all of the people in my racial group. Just think about these small things every day. She had 168 of these questions.
Yeah, right.
And remember, we were talking about microaggressions, you know, so no wonder people are tired.
Mm.
It's exhausting.
Yeah. We'll put a link up to that Peggy McIntosh reading on the program page. Yeah. If this is the first time you may be coming across the term white fragility, I have seen that there are people who are a little bit sensitive to discussions around it. Tanya, do we have any tips on how to talk about this with white friends and family about the concept, and how we can do it in a way that doesn't immediately strike like a super defensive chord with someone?
Yeah. I always remember I did a writing course with Catherine Devini, and she taught me that offense is taken, not given.
Yeah.
So we need to remember that it's not often not what we said, but it's the other person choosing to respond in a certain way. So I think, you know, my life motto is disrupt with kindness, right? So bring our curiosity to the situation, right? We need to understand that we don't know what others' lived experience is, and we can ask other folk to be curious as well. It is intensely important for us to speak to listen rather than to be heard, right? And we need to acknowledge that this is an uncomfortable topic. Anything in life that we want to change, or any system that we want to change, is going to be uncomfortable for people. So instead of trying to push our discomfort at hearing this back on the people who already have the discomfort, we need to be able to sit with the discomfort of what's coming up here and how we are in some way complicit. We need to understand that it's important to acknowledge different or unfair treatment to certain groups of people, even if we don't do it, right? And we need to understand that racism is systemic. And I've mentioned this before, that it's built into our social system. It's everywhere. So drop your defenses, listen generously, and encourage people around you to listen generously. As a white person, don't center yourself. Center people of color and other minorities. Use their voices. Point people to people speaking. And don't expect folks of color or marginalized people to educate you about their situation. It's exhausting for them. We can do some reading. We can get ourselves educated, but we also need to understand that we're complicit in a system that is not fair. And what are we going to do about that? Yeah. We need to understand that sometimes we're in the group that's oppressing other people. Other times we might be in a group that's being oppressed. This is the hierarchy, and we spoke about this last time. And don't make grand assumptions, right? I was just chatting to Maya in the break that there's a debate going on my Facebook page at the moment about people assuming that taking down statues of people who didn't treat the traditional owners of our land or who promoted slavery is in some way erasing or changing history. It's not. It's actually being sensitive to folk who may be traumatized or triggered by the statue. And it's trying to highlight that there are other parts of history that don't need to be recognized or celebrated and haven't been, right?
So true.
Yeah, we need patience for these kinds of conversations and to understand that it's really difficult and uncomfortable. But this is what marginalized people feel like all of the time.
Mm.
So we can't keep expecting them to wear our discomfort. That's not cool.
No. We have a whole list of resources will pop up on the program page as well. Just after this next song by Hedy Wan and Fred Again, we're going to go into a little bit more about how to try and change behavior and combat these ways if you feel like you don't have a place to start. So don't go anywhere on Mornings. There's another language warning on this one. on Mornings. That is Hedy One and Fred again with No Me. I'm here with Tanya Coons. We are talking about the politics of pleasure. And before, we were mentioning how there are some ways you can help combat bad and not the right learnt behaviours is the word I'm trying to say. And one of the ways that Tanya mentioned we can do this is by healing through the body. Give us the spiel, Tanya. Is this something we can use in our own lives when dealing with different kinds of negative traumas?
Yeah, it totally is. And this is I think there's a new awareness of this kind of healing coming up now. And a lot more study being seen. This is an area that I've studied in because, you know, working in sex, you do come across trauma all the time. So I think teaching people how to connect to their bodies and for us as well, learning to connect to our body and paying attention to what our body is saying to us. Because I'll often say to people, where in your body do you hold your stress? And, you know, half the people I say that to will be like, oh, well, it's in my shoulders or in my belly or in my butt or in my pelvis. And the other half will just look at me blankly and say, what? Say what? What are you talking about? And I'm like, yeah, no, we hold a lot of our emotions and feelings in the body. And ways that we can help other people who've been traumatized or who are experiencing trauma or triggering is to co-regulate, right? So being around a person who's calm really calms other folk down. Telling someone to calm down, I don't think has ever worked in the history of being told to calm down ever.
No.
But if we take deep breaths and if we down-regulate our body and if we move slowly, if we encourage folk to sit down, that's really going to help them calm. And I think even breathing is a radical act, right? Slow down, drop into your body, coach others to do the same. It's going to calm you down, but also inform you what's going on. And then there are things like spiritual practices where people are doing manifestations and prayer, meditation, rituals, singing. You know, and a bunch of folk I know on the weekend were doing winter solstice stuff. Those kinds of things help us connect with the land, with our culture, with our spiritualism. And they are healing. There are lots of academic papers coming out now about how these work. And one of the things I love, and I just want to finish with a little story, is you can heal via performance. You can tell your story using movement and dance and words, and it will actually heal what's happened to you. And I saw a performance last year at the Sydney Opera House by Genoa Gala, and she used storytelling and singing and Islander dance to tell her story. But one of the most powerful things she did was pull white people out of the audience to play her telling her stories on the stage. And she told a story about being at Redfern train station and being approached by the police and asked to move on. Oh. So she picked this enormously tall white guy and had him play her. So she's like, just picture me standing on Redfern station, two police people come up and ask you to move on. And because you're me, I just want you to say, why? So this guy says, why? And she said, now look, now there's four policemen coming towards you and asking you to move on. And then she coached the audience. What are we learning here? Don't run, because you could end up shot, like, and she named a lot of people. Keep your voice calm, keep your regulation. So now these four policemen are escorting you off the stage. And again, because you're me, why don't you wave at all the commuters that are staring at you being escorted, right? So the guy waves and she's like, oh, look, now one of the policemen is taking out his gun and taking the lock off it. Uh-huh. What have we learned here? And the whole audience was sitting on the edge of their seats. And she debriefed with the guy afterwards and she said, how was that for you? And he's like, I've never been so afraid in all my life. And she said, yes, and probably this is the only time you'll ever feel like this, whereas this is my lived experience every day.
Oh, boy.
Right? Powerful. I can't stop thinking about it. It's been a year since I saw that performance. And it's making me very, very thoughtful about what is going on to folk who are existing right next door to us.
Mm.
And I think we need to do that and hopefully not be pulled up on a stage to learn it, but try and think a little more carefully and understand too, teaching people how to access pleasure, you know, helping traumatized and marginalized people be able to calm and to co-regulate and to find pleasure in their bodies or with folk around them is a really important thing that we can do.
Absolutely. Tanya, always spouting so much wisdom. We have a slew of resources we're going to pop up on the program page to go with today's episode of Let's Talk About Sex. We're going to have to leave it there. It's so good to see you, even though it's through Zoom. Thank you so much for everything.